Hello, listeners.
Hello, listeners. Hello, any new listeners, because we're recording this the week after we just released our episode with Johnny Chiodini about the world's worst D&D class, and it seems like a whole lot of new listeners, beautiful, wonderful nerds, have crawled out of the woodwork, blinking at the sight of daylight, and found our little podcast.
Whoa, let us, don't nerd shame people, oh, let's not...
We completely live under that rock with them all, Ben, let's be honest, or crawling through that dungeon.
Okay, I mean, I guess that's right. I like to think that I'm, to steal from Eddie Izzard, I'm an executive nerd. And I live in a penthouse rock, enjoying some artisanal lichen for as part of my diet. Anyway, this is our way of saying thank you for getting on board, and hope we've had quite a few nice comments about that episode with Johnny. If you did enjoy that, firstly, we've got about 120 other episodes we reckon you'll like, including, which ones did we think?
I reckon you will probably enjoy World's Worst Board Game, which we did way back in episode 8 or 9 with Paul Flannery, who has worked with Johnny, and also Worst Game with board game designer Jamie Stegmeier, who's the designer of games like Scythe and Charterstone and Viticulture, if you know any of those.
There's World's Worst Night, which we did with Paul Duncan McGarrity, who's someone who's a comedian, an archaeologist, and a game player with us.
And World's Worst Emperor with Tom Bell, who has played Lord Fear in the epic show Nightmare Live as well, which we think you'll also enjoy.
So that's stuff for you to cherry pick. And if you enjoy those, if you enjoyed the episode with Johnny, listen, you're probably well-versed podcast listeners, but the biggest thing you can do to help us is pop on your podcast app of choice, like us, review us, favourably, please.
Yes, yeah. 5 stars is the nice thing to do.
Yeah, like 5 stars is the only acceptable review.
Yeah, we've both got mortgages to pay.
And we pay them via star ratings on iTunes.
Yes. Yeah. Are you not getting the dividends from iTunes?
No.
Oh. Well, this is awkward.
This is deeply awkward. But anyway, do that and subscribe us and tell your friends and all that business. If you want to contact us, you're very welcome to do so on worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. We've had a couple of people get in contact recently to suggest guests, which is totally allowed. If you want to suggest topics, then that is a Patreon bonus you can do by looking at patreon.com/worstfootforward.
You can also find us on Twitter, where a lot of our friends, old and indeed new listeners, have engaged us quite a lot. We love having tweets and long chats, and one of our regular listeners, Martin, likes live tweeting his reaction to the episodes as he listens along with them, which is really nice. And you can find us on Twitter on @worstfoot, and Ben's on @BenVandeveld. I'm on @BazMaxDay.
Coming up for our next bunch of recordings, we've got a couple of Patreon ones. We've got Sarah Pettit, who works in the legal profession in the deep south of America, and is a Patreon supporter, and she's coming on to talk about the world's worst tycoon. We have got a luchadore ice hockey mascot called the Ultimate Predator, who's coming to talk about the world's worst disguise. We've got comedian Ishan Akbar, who recently appeared on Frankie Boyle's New World Order on BBC One to talk about the world's worst banker.
He's a former banker, of course.
He is a former banker, a deeply amoral human. That is not true, sorry, Ishan. And we've got a comedian, actor, improviser, and fellow Crystal Maze Master, because there's not been enough of those recently, Angus Dunican, to talk about the world's worst apology,
which is another Patreon suggested topic.
Yeah, it is. So loads of exciting stuff coming up, and we've also we've got one podcast crossover that we're looking to do with a couple of very exciting history academics that we're not going to tell you about, but if it comes up, it's going to be so cool.
Yeah, very excited. So that's your summer laid out. It's like a summer of sport, summer of podcast laid out for you. Meanwhile, this week we're talking about the world's worst hosts. Spoiler alert, it's not either of us.
No.
It might be Ben.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that each week celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vandeveld, and this week we'd like to welcome you to our own Worst Foot dinner party. We've taken your jackets and thrown them on at the children's bed rather than our own, so they'll come back covered in lollipop juice and sputum. Then we tried to go in for the French double cheek kiss, but ended up miscounting your cheeks and kissing you on the lips twice. As our honoured guest, you get the pride of place on the two deck chairs by the pop-up card table, and later get to enjoy a choice of house wines, warm, corked, or watered down. The menu consists of prawn cocktail, cock prawn tail, followed by a cheese board of the three main types, slices, triangle, and rind. After some mild passive-aggressive chat and talcum powder cigars, we'll call you a cab before you're ready and leave you waiting outside in the rain while standing in the hallway loudly talking about what we thought your major flaws were. Obviously, we'll be shocked and appalled when you don't send a card thanking us for our hospitality. And with me is the host with the most one-star reviews on TripAdvisor, it's Barry McStay.
Lollipop juice and sputum sounds like a evil version of Snap, Crackle and Pop.
Yeah, that's their nemesis.
Yeah. through the mirror, they're the evil version, the darkest timeline versions of.
Yeah, they're the Coraline version of it.
It's nice to just have the two of us for once at this dinner party with a guest joining us remotely.
Yeah,
so that we get to have all the rind to ourselves and the cock prawn tail.
Delicious crunchy cheese rind.
Yeah, this is our the first time we've done one of these Patreon specials. So our $10 and above people who support us on Patreon get to judge an episode.
When we say judge an episode, we mean judge who is the winner on an episode. Because you're all technically allowed to judge an episode on iTunes, 5 stars and above only.
Only. Can you do 6 stars on iTunes?
If you're good enough at coding to reprogram the entire iTunes website and give us a 6-star.
Former guest friend of the show, Andrew Somerville, could definitely
he's so good. Our guest judge today, who you're going to introduce in a minute, she is donating $10 a month to us, for which we thank her, and also is a former guest on the show as well.
Indeed.
Turns out she had such a good time, she wanted to support the show.
Yeah, our guest this week appeared, ages ago now, somewhere in the 60s or 70s, I think, in our episodes, talking about the world's worst quiz show contestant. And we talked about murderous appearances on British game shows. Epic fails by people getting the answer wrong to questions where they were wearing a t-shirt with the answer on it. She also has in her back catalogue an appearance as the winning captain of a team on Only Connect, my favourite game show or quiz show here in the UK. And since appearing on Worst Foot Forward, she has gone on to even headier nerdy heights as an elf on the excellent QI, where she snuffles about in the mines of knowledge to present Sandy Toksvig with little nuggets to feed to us on a Thursday or Friday night, depending on the scheduling. She's joining us via Skype with a cup of tea and a library of books behind her, all of them looking very learned, ready to preside over us, pince-nez delicately balanced on the end of her nose. So please welcome Lydia Mizon.
Hello!
Hi, it's so good to see you again.
It's lovely to be back, thank you.
We were saying to Lydia just before the show, she's only the second person to make a second appearance on the show after Paul Flannery, who's done 2 episodes, so that's, you know.
If anyone starts a Wikipedia page of the guests on us, it'll be very boring and long. Yeah. But you'll be in the top.
Yeah, you'll be at the top of the list, like appearances 2, your 2 names, and then 1 for everybody else.
What do you now do for QI? Because I think for us and a lot of our listeners, that is a hell of a dream job.
And would you like to tell anyone who doesn't know the show overseas and so on what QI is?
So QI, it stands for quite interesting. It was founded about 15 years ago by John Lloyd, who is responsible for basically everything that I love, which is Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Blackadder, etc., etc. Spitting Image, huge behind that. And it basically is a television show that works on the premise that you can make anything interesting. So I think it started off as a sort of debunking common myths and assumptions about things as a panel show. It used to be presented by Stephen Fry, now by Sandy Toksvig. And it's just sort of evolved over time into this beautiful exploration of things that you didn't know. Anything that's interesting or a slight angle to the universe, we want to hear about it. So at the moment I have quite a minor role in that I mainly do facts for the Twitter feed, interesting quotes and stuff. That's your sort of entry-level elf job. I am crawling my way up the ladder and eventually, hopefully, I hope to take over the whole company and then the world.
And very much Ben and I inspired by QI when we started the podcast. Oh, yeah. And very kindly, Lydia had just started her job, I think a month or two, when we did our episode about the world's worst adverts with Ollie Powell, in which I had fallen for an online hoax for my suggestion.
Oh, yeah.
And had to put out an apology the next day in retraction. And Lydia very kindly tweeted and said you'd have to retract about 4 or 5 facts already from the QI feed.
Oh, God, yeah. amazing. I think Andrew Hunter-Murray, one of the other elves, has got a little saying that he says sometimes, which is too good to fact check. Yeah. Sometimes yes. You see something and you're like, that's brilliant. I'm 99% sure it's bollocks. But I really want it to be true. Like, there was something I submitted that contractually, the Bruce Willis's role in Die Hard contractually had to be offered first to Frank Sinatra. Like, when I submitted that, it came back almost immediately. Like, all of us have found this fact. We all love it. It's not true. Like, it seems to have sort of bounced around the elves as, like, something which we... we'd love that to be true, but it's just not. So we do try and fact check everything. You get people after every episode, after every tweet, coming up and saying, actually, I think you'll find that it's not entirely true. But we try as hard as we can to make sure that everything is 100% accurate.
I would love to see Sinatra in Die Hard. Yippee my way, motherfucker. Ben gave me the comedian nod of going, I was literally about to say the same thing.
I had the good news. I'll level with you. What was really happening was I was struggling to get the scansion right. So I let the professional playwright do it instead.
You only get one pass at saying that.
I sort of like took a left turn at hosting and looked at toasting instead, specifically.
Was that a typo?
It was a typo and I just went down the wiki hole. But like Toastmasters, who are essentially like the host of banquets and large meals. So there are various ideas of where the word to toast came from. It's first found in the Merry Wives of Windsor when Falstaff, who I didn't realise turns up in the Merry Wives of Windsor.
Yeah, he's like Shakespeare's Joey. He like did Friends, then he was on Spin Off, like keeps bringing him back, shows him into Henry the Fourth and Fifth, maybe Sixth, I think as well.
Yeah, Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth,
and yeah, Merry Wives of Windsor as
I
well.
I think Merry Wives of Windsor was written to bring back Falstaff. Was Elizabeth I really liked him, or somebody important really liked him, and was like, oh, wish we'd seen more of that Falstaff guy, and he was like, well, I guess I'll just get writing. So yeah.
I think because he was the comic relief in the history plays, and then they're like, no, we want a full-blown comedy all about this dude.
Wow, and there should be another one where Falstaff lives with his retired dad and his dad's dog and his really heavier-drinking younger brother.
Hosts a phone-in show.
Yeah. You would not want advice from Falstaff on a phone-in show.
You're having sort of marital problems? You should drink more.
Yeah. That is literally John Belushi's solution to problems in Animal House. But he says in the Merry Wives, go fetch me a quart of sack, put a toast in it. It is thought that he's referring literally to toast because the quality of wine was so poor, so popping a bit of toast in the jug would soak up some of the acidity and improve the flavour.
Yeah, you dip it in it, yeah.
The importance of toasting goes all the way back. So, 1st century BCE, the Roman Senate decreed that the health of the Emperor Augustus had to be drunk at every meal. But that sort of sounds like a state-sanctioned drinking game.
Yes.
From where I was at. And the poet Martial described a Roman party practice in which each guest had to drink as many glasses of wine as were in the letters of his mistress's name. And he said, that's a real issue if your mistress is called Prosperina or Messalina.
Yeah, I've heard the long-named prostitutes were in high demand.
That's when double-barreled names started popping up.
What's your name, Julia? Not enough.
Yeah. there is the first example of toasting in Britain is in the writings of Geoffrey of Monmouth, who wrote the History of the Kings of Britain. And he talks about it happening in 450 CE. The honour of the British king Vortigern, and he's like toasting. The leader of his Saxon allies raises a glass to him and says, good health. And the king is so hammered and so swept off of his feet, he immediately proposes marriage to the toaster's daughter. It's the sort of toast I'm after. There's an Anglo-Saxon tradition of when you toast, you three guests stand up at the same time. One person to pass the cup, one to drink, and the other one to defend the temporarily defenceless drinker. Because when you lift the glass, your flanks are open.
I see. It sounds like that improv game, Sans Sit Neil.
Yeah, yes, it does.
One person has to be standing at all times, one person has to be drinking,
the other
person
has to be called Neil.
Yeah. Wielding a sword.
Yeah. And it's apparently because in the 10th century, King Edward II was stabbed to death whilst drinking a cup of mead, and he was stabbed to death by his stepmother.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's like proper red wedding stuff, that, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, really is. Toasting became really popular in sort of the Renaissance and Enlightenment period. And it became a bit sort of like, lads, 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 and a way to show off to women. And you'd get like these sort of braggadocious men who would show off their valiance by pricking their arms, bleeding into a drink, and drinking wine mixed with their own blood.
Oh, I had friends at uni like that.
Yeah, rugby lads.
Yeah.
And there were books published on toasting and how to toast. One of the most famous early ones was by a man called Jay Roach. And the book was titled The Royal Toastmaster, containing many thousands of the best toasts old and new to give brilliancy to the mirth and make joys of the glass supremely agreeable. And a couple of these included...
That's a really long title.
Yes.
Did he have to drink a shot for every letter in the word of his book title?
Yep. These are two great toasts. One of his, Confusion to the Minions of Vice. And the other one is, May Reason Be the Pilot When Passion Blows the Gale. I found a couple of other great toasts here, and this is from 1906. Here's to man. He is like a kerosene lamp. He is not over bright. He is often turned down. He generally smokes, and he frequently goes out at night. There's a toast from The Perfect Gentleman in 1860, which is specifically, and this is good for introverts, a toast for when you're stuck at a party with people you don't like.
Oh, that's totally me.
Yeah. May he who is an ass and takes himself to be a deer find out his mistake when he comes to leap at a ditch.
It's a head scratcher, that one. Nobody at the party's really going to catch it if they've had enough drinks at that point.
But the thing is, as everyone at the party is going, what the fuck was he on about? You just sneak out of there.
What do they say in? Because all the different cheers that you say around the world are always quite fun as well.
I only found a couple of those in Belarusian. You say "Budzma," which means "May we live."
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, but most of them, like, because in Yiddish and Hebrew, you've got "L'chaim," which is to life, is much more exhortive. But "May we live" seems like they're asking the Russians.
Yeah, in Irish you say "slánce," which is health.
Yes.
And I always like "na zdrowie," which is the is that the Polish and the Russian one?
Yes.
Yeah, it just sounds good. "Na zdrowie."
Yeah, it's like all Russian words, very aggressive. Yeah,
particularly when you're like clinking some, you know, some glasses full of vodka or whatever. You can just, yeah, you can hear the clink in it.
Well, I heard about the reason, apparently one of the reasons why you clink is because it was because people in medieval or even Renaissance courts would be worried about poisoning. So you'd clink the glasses together so the liquid would move from one cup to another. So sort of doing double jeopardy with the...
We all go down together.
Yeah.
Is that why you make eye... You're meant to make eye contact with everyone when you cheers as well. And you're meant to cheers everybody. You sort of like... So you're looking that person in the eye and you're making sure that, you know, they're going to kill me, you've looked me in the eye and this is like a bonding moment.
Yeah, well, I think it's more just going, we're going to clink, the drinks are going to mingle, so there is no incentive to poison because we'd all go down.
Yeah.
There's other superstitions. The United States Navy, you should never make a toast with water.
Oh, yeah, I've heard
because
that
if you do, then the person being toasted will suffer a watery grave.
And isn't there one about you shouldn't clink with an empty glass?
Probably.
I think I've heard that one. I've been at things where people like insist they put some liquid into my glass, but then it's usually water from the water jug, so, you know, they're making a rod for their own backs.
Well, maybe they're trying to tell you something.
Yeah. That's, I imagine at the recent banquet, the Queen kept trying to toast Donald Trump with an empty glass.
Yeah.
Because apparently everything the Queen does is to throw shade at another aged racist.
Yeah.
There is, in the British Navy, a different toast for every day of the week.
Oh, yeah.
So Monday is our ships at sea. Tuesday is our sailors. Wednesday is ourselves. Thursday is a bloody war, a sickly season. Friday is a willing foe and a sea room. Which seems kind of like, to you, the foe, but also may you end up in Davy Jones's locker. Saturday is our families and Sunday is absent friends.
Is Saturday the one that used to be our wives and girlfriends?
Our wives and sweethearts.
Yes.
May they never meet.
Yeah. it's the only one I know.
The last little thing I found out about, and this is one I was tempted to go for, the worst host, because toasting became such a part of culture... an anti-toasting movement grew up, which is basically the seedlings of the temperance movement. And this was, unsurprisingly, from the Puritans, who every party needs a Puritan locked in a closet.
They love clinking with an empty glass.
Yes, they did. So there's a guy called William Prine, who in 1628 wrote an entire book called The Health Sickness, in which he complained about this drinking and quaffing of healths had its origin and birth from pagans, heathens, and infidels, yea, and from the very devil himself.
And to the bride and groom.
Yeah. And brilliantly, in 1664, Samuel Pepys attended a dinner that Prynne was at, and he said that Prynne sat there sternly refusing to drink to anyone's health, including the king, and sat down with his hat on all the time, glaring at all the company.
Oh, what a prick.
Yeah, and I like to think that Pepys was just disgusted with his company.
Yeah, particularly knowing how much of a philanderer and a drinker Pepys was.
Yeah.
And he's sitting next to Prynne.
Yeah, I just imagine Pepys just going, come on, buddy, come on, William, like, let's liven it up a bit.
It's like putting George Best next to Steve Davis at like the Sports Personality of the Year Awards or something.
I reckon Steve Davis is a secret toker. Because yes. He's into DJing. And look look at next time you watch the snooker, look at Steve Davis. His eyes are like pinholes in the snow.
He's pot black.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, nice bit of Nepalese temple ball. Nom, 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 nom. What else did you find?
We were going to talk about quiz show hosts very briefly.
Seems appropriate for Lydia.
Lydia, obviously you appeared on Only Connected with one of the best quiz show hosts in the biz, Victoria Karen Mitchell.
Yeah. Is she as nice / cutting in real life as she seems on screen?
She's so nice.
Good.
I really take great pleasure in telling everyone she's exactly the same off screen as she is on screen. And before we filmed the first episode, she said, look, even if you guys walk out of here with a score of 0, you've done as well as most people that are watching at home.
Oh, that's a good pep talk.
You've got here, and she's brilliant. She's really, really lovely.
Yeah, I think the best thing about her is that she has that air of someone who is clever enough to know that's the thing, is she's got this thing of like, I feel like you could know all the answers, but she plays up the idea that she doesn't understand the answers, which is great, because there are going to be really clever people who still won't understand some of the answers that only connect. And so she doesn't dumb herself down too much, but still... Yeah. Admits when things are really complicated. As well as which, I like that she writes very much introductions for the show just for her own amusement, it seems like.
Yeah, and she comes up with them, I mean, sort of not quite on the fly, but she sort of takes a couple of seconds before to sort of think through what she's going to say. And then she said, and I said at one point, like, do you do those yourself? And she sort of looked at me like, nobody else is going to be writing this shit. I'm making this up. But no, she's brilliant.
Yeah, I think she's excellent. I just basically had a quick ransack of my brains of who are really bad quiz show hosts in the UK. Yep. Robert Kilroy Silk came to mind.
Oh, God, yeah.
Hosting, what was that show called?
Shafted.
And where the catchphrase was, do they want to share or to shaft?
And every time he did it, he'd do this really unpleasant fisting motion.
Yeah, like a sort of like a Mediterranean swear.
Yes. Which is quite oddly inappropriate for someone who supported British nationalist parties so often.
Yes, yes. I thought of Jasper Carrot, the host of Golden Balls.
The game was bad. I'm not sure it was his.
Yeah. Well, I think the problem was the Golden Balls was quite a complicated game. That the rules seemed very nebulous. And Jasper Carrot, unlike Victoria Karen Mitchell, does not have the air of someone who completely understands things all the time. So when you've got a really complicated show, to put sort of a folk comedian from the 70s who has a slightly sort of out of his depth vibe, it doesn't really sort of sing confidently.
No, and I also thought of a good match.
I also really enjoy Tipping Point, the game show, which is hosted by Ben Shepherd.
I love that show.
Which is basically British people. It's just that the penny push machines on the piers in Brighton. In America, it's like you drop in America. It'd be a bit like that Plinko, the game on The Price is Right. You drop a coin into a thing and it lands, but then at the bottom it lands on this plateau of moving coins, and hopefully it'll land at a point where it'll push some of the coins that are already there down into the sort of the thing at the bottom. You win some coins. But they've made a game show out of it, where essentially the host, Ben Shepherd's job is to go to the contestant before they drop an oversized penny. So do you think it's going to... What do you think? Is it gonna knock a thing off, or is it not going to knock the thing off?
I mean, what you really need there is someone who is a expert in Brownian motion. That's what I read.
Oh my god, I would genuinely love that if they'd brought someone on that would go, actually, right, I think I've done the calculations and I think that would be excellent. But it's it's simplistic and it's based on luck, but I really like Tipping Point. I think it's sort of hypnotic in its strangeness.
It has that. It fills an excellent void in the middle of sort of daytime programming. It's just the thing of going, I need something that's on. It's not too taxing, and I can leave the room and come back and not feel like I've missed anything. however, I think the worst quiz show host may not be my nominee overall, but I is definitely Anne Widdecombe. Anne Widdecombe, for overseas listeners, is one-time Shadow Home Secretary in the... Was she actual Home Secretary for a while as well?
No, she actually held some office in government, but nothing too important.
And she was a Conservative Member of Parliament for about 15 years. She was a staunch Catholic. When she left Parliament, there was talk of her going to be the British ambassador to the Vatican. Strongly right-wing views. She's now just been elected as a member for the European Parliament for the Brexit Party. And just over the weekend was on TV talking about maybe science down the line will find a way to, you know, figure out how to fix gayness.
I don't want to judge someone on how they look, but I am about to. She, obviously, I think she is aligned sort of politically and morally with someone like Ann Coulter in the United States.
Yes.
However, because Ann Coulter is an American TV personality, she has the shimmer of glamour around her, much like an evil elf. And... I think that Anne Widdecombe is what Anne Coulter's soul actually looks like.
She's the painting in Anne Coulter's attic.
And her voice.
Her voice is the voice recording in Anne Coulter's attic as well. And her shamble is the walk in Anne Coulter's walking cupboard.
She's a rancid little racist goblin.
I am not a fan. She appeared on Strictly Come Dancing, our version of Dancing with the Stars for American listeners, where she was inexplicably kept in by the public for about 10 weeks because it was so funny to watch an aged former politician and a lifelong, fascist to be flung around by a ballroom dancer in sparkly sequin dresses, and at one point be lowered down on wires doing the least elegant arm flapping you've ever seen. But she hosted the satirical panel show Have I Got News For You a couple of times, and on the first occasion she was relatively good. I mean, the host job on Have I Got News For You is to sit and read the teleprompter where the jokes are there for them to read them and to throw the topic to the panelists who are going to be funny about it. And the first time she stopped racist is right once every couple of hours. no, they're wrong all the time. She had a fairly good debut, and so they invited her back. And Paul Merton, the team captain on the show, says that she was the worst host the show ever had on her second appearance. She tried to rewrite jokes. She told the producers what she thought would work and what wouldn't work. She was bossing everyone around. And then during the recording, turned to Paul at one point and said, "Go on, be amusing. It's what you're paid to do."
Oh, yeah. That's the equivalent of saying to a policeman, "I pay your wages."
Yeah. She said she wouldn't go back on the show if they paid her. They had paid her. I think the thing is that they were like, we're not going to have you back even if you pay us. But then she was given a game show on Sky Atlantic in 2012. She hosted a show called Clever Dicks. They filmed... it's a terrible name. In fact, Clever Dicks was the working title for another British game show, Eggheads. But they filmed 30 episodes of this, a whole series of it, presumably in an afternoon. And the whole premise is, it's aimed at people who are, and I quote, irritatingly and ostentatiously knowledgeable or intelligent. It takes one to know one, was her introduction. I'm Anne Widdecombe, and this is Clever Dicks, implying that she is a clever dick.
She's got... I'm Anne Widdecombe and I am irritatingly intelligent. I mean, one out of two.
It's so grating, the entire premise. Not only that, every time someone gets a question right, she goes, oh, clever dick. All the people who are contestants on the show are, like, former winners of other British game shows. So they had people who'd appeared on Only Connect.
Oh my
and
God.
On Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and so on, and on Eggheads. And she says, at the start of one of the shows, she says, I know why I'm a clever dick. It's because I read Latin and Greek at university. And for that matter, I nearly ran the country. Not true. she stood for Tory leadership. She did not get close to winning.
She's trying to channel Anne Robinson, I think, from The Weakest Link. Although I'm fairly certain of it. Whilst I find Anne Robinson impossible to watch on the telly, I've heard in person she's actually quite nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a persona, I think. Yes. Because she was on... Anne Robinson's on Watchdog and stuff. Like, she's not like that all the time, but she's... You can see how that evolved, that Anne Widdecombe. You can see why people thought it would be a good idea, but it's... Like everything Anne Widdecombe does, it's not a good idea.
Yeah, she played up the whole, like, school marm, matronly, sarcastic thing. But her banter, not great. Not great banter.
She's, like, Anne Widdecombe is like the Trunchbull if she failed to represent Britain at the Olympics.
You had something about a quiz show host as well, didn't you?
Was it a quiz show host? Yes, it was. So this was from India. She's called Isha the Goddess. And the game is called Dadagiri or Dadagiri. And the program, it's sort of like, you know, those Japanese shows from the 80s and 90s that were the inspiration for Jungle. I'm a celebrity, get me out of here, all that.
Sort of humiliation.
Yeah, got to do that, and you've got to take abuse from, like, people on the show. But early doors in season one, it got a little bit full on. So she basically started abusing a contestant, and the contestant wouldn't take it and gave her back chat. And so she just told them to fuck off and slapped him in the face.
Wow!
And he slapped her right back.
Wow!
And there was just this Mexican standoff between host and guest.
Were they playing that school ground game Slaps?
They absolutely were not. Although, that would be an amazing primetime TV show.
After Tipping Point.
And before Conkers. Are you telling me you wouldn't want to see Celebrity Slaps?
No, I would queue up to appear on Celebrity Slaps. Yeah. If I could pick the celebrity, I'd get the slap.
Yeah, if it was like Jay Rayner versus Annika Rice.
They're both quite nice. I want to hit Vernon Kay. Yeah. Vernon Kay and James Corden.
You've got to have, like, the heel and the face. So you've got to have, oh God, I don't know. Who would you have? Like, Chris Akabusi facing off against Jeremy Kyle. So we need to, those are two very British references. So for America, you'd want to have Geraldo Rivera.
against Michael Johnson.
Michael Johnson, yeah. I mean, I was going to say against the Reverend Al Sharpton.
This is a format that writes itself.
It really is. Every time Geraldo... Because Geraldo would, like... You'd think it would go for Hal. Geraldo would just slap the Reverend in the face.
Yeah.
And every time just go, aren't you meant to turn the other cheek, Reverend? Whack.
Do they want to slap or to shaft?
That's a different show.
Yeah.
That is a very different show. That's on Babe Station with Robert Kilroy Silk. Sorry.
So
yeah, that's all I found on that. And I also found, which I'm sure you've got a bit more on, stuff about, well, I looked at awards hosts briefly. So the Oscars has got quite a checkered history of some fairly bad hosts. 1934, Will Rogers, famous vaudevillian and comedian cowboy, and he hosted it, and he was responsible for one of the biggest gaffes in history. Huh. He was announcing the winner for Best Director, and he decided to ad-lib! And he ad-libbed by going, "Well, well, well, what do you know? I've watched this young man for a long time, saw him come up from the bottom, and I mean the bottom. It couldn't happen to a nicer guy. Come up and get it, Frank." At that point, Frank Capra, nominated for Lady for a Day, stood up and made his way to the stage. However, the spotlight settled on the real winner, Frank Lloyd, who had directed Cavalcade. And Frank Capra described getting back to his seat as the longest crawl in history.
Oh, that reminds me of the 2015 Miss Universe pageant.
Go on.
Steve Harvey, who hosts the American version of Family Fortunes, I think it's called Family Feud in America, he announced the winner as Miss Columbia, and not the real winner, Miss Philippines. There were 4.5 minutes where Miss Columbia was wearing the crown and holding the bouquet of flowers and waving, and Miss Philippines clapping at the back. And then Steve Harvey had to come on stage and go, "I have to apologise." And people are still whooping and cheering, so he's waiting. It's clearly someone's in his ear going, "Steve, you have to fix this." And he's sort of waiting for the crowd to shut up. And then he has to go, the win. And then he goes, Miss Universe 2015 is Miss Philippines. And he's holding up the card. And it's really awful. Miss Philippines walks down and gets to come down. And he's like, "Miss Philippines, take your walk. Your first walk as Miss Universe 2015. And there's a really obvious moment where Miss Philippines looks at Miss Columbia and is wondering, "Do I take the crown back off your head?" And then he compounded it by tweeting an apology to Miss Columbia, spelt with a U, and Miss Philippians, spelt like the book of the Bible. he did later have Miss Columbia on his chat show and did an interview with her where he said he needed her to forgive her, him, and she did indeed. And she said it was a human mistake. He gave her, she hugged him and told him it was all right. And he said what had actually happened is he'd read the auto cue rather than the card just in front of him. Then later he slightly changed the story. He said, no, he read the card, but the card they had in rehearsals just had a country's name in it, where the card he had in the live show had the first runner-up and the second runner-up and the Miss Universe winner all sort of on the same page. So he found it a bit more confusing. Ariadna Gutierrez, Miss Columbia, said, "It was the worst night of my life, but also the best," in fairness to her.
That was beautiful, because anyone in Miss Universe or a beauty pageant has got to always end on a positive.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Do you know who hosted... Lydia, I'll ask you this, because Barry can see the answer. Lydia, do you know who hosted the Oscars in 1958? Or was part of the team who hosted it in 1958?
No.
Okay. Sorry, I could have asked a more specific
question. A Hollywood icon.
Okay.
Maybe not human.
Oh.
Famous for not wearing all of his clothes.
But not human.
Yeah.
Lassie?
That would have been such a good Oscar host.
Yeah, and the winner for Best Director is... What's that boy? He's stuck down a hole? that would be incredible. No, it was...
Here's your Oscar. Fetch.
it was Donald Duck.
Amazing.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, of course. Yeah.
So, yeah, it was the first time they were ever broadcast live, and they needed to fill some time, and they decided to throw in something extra alongside the live hosts. Yeah, so they popped in Donald Duck. Their reasoning being that Donald Duck had won an Oscar in 1943 for Best Animated Short for a film called Der Führer's Face, where he dreams that he is in Nazi Germany and having to work in a factory where he constantly gives Hitler salutes to a production line of photos of Hitler.
Wow.
And at the end, he wakes up and it was all a dream and he's in America and staring at the Statue of Liberty with a tear in his eye.
To be fair, with that big bill, you mightn't be able to see the pencil moustache.
Yeah.
Under there.
Good point. Do you know who Donald Duck was apparently named after?
Donald Trump.
No. Apparently, he might have been inspired by cricketing legend Donald Bradman.
Oh, really?
Because in 1932, shortly before...
You don't want a duck named after you as a cricketer.
Well, but the Australian team were touring North America in 1932, and it's funny you should say that. Apparently, apparently Donald Bradman was dismissed for a duck against the New York West Indians.
That's no runs for our American.
Yes, no runs is what it is.
So, because a golden duck is you're out first ball of the match, and I think a diamond duck is you're out the first ball of a test series or something, and so a Donald duck is you're out. First ball against the North Americans when not wearing pants.
Yeah. One final Oscar host, Chevy Chase, renowned for being an enormous bell end. He co-hosted in 1987 at the Oscars, so he got the solo gig in 1988. He opened with Good Evening, Hollywood Phonies.
Yeah.
And then it basically went downward from there.
Yeah, he seemed quite bitter all the, any time he appears in those sort of situations. Because I read about him appearing on SNL.
Yes.
Which I know both of us have seen, looked at. Yes. So Saturday Night Live, again, people over here might have heard of, iconic American live comedy sketch show, different hosts each week. Usually a celebrity, an actor or a singer or a sports person or a politician even.
Yep.
Major figure. And the guest host... is sort of the central player each week.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously some people better than others at appearing on live comedy TV.
Yeah.
Chevy Chase was an original cast member. He was the breakout star after the first season in 1975. And he left the show after the first season to go off and do films and all that. But he did come back and hosted 8 times between 1978 and 1997. On his first return, he got into a fist fight with Bill Murray, who had replaced him on the show. He was broken up by Dan Aykroyd, apparently. And in 1997, the last time he hosted, he hit Sherry O'Terry, who was a cast member of the show, on the back of her head, leading him to be banned from hosting ever again by Lorne Michaels, the legendary producer of the show. Yeah.
What an awful prick.
Yeah, major prick.
I found out about that. They actually weren't a bad host, but I didn't know about this. They held a competition in the 70s for an anyone can host SNL.
Wow.
And on 1977, the winner was the 80-year-old German immigrant and grandmother from New Orleans, Mischel Spielman.
Oh, wow.
I mean, they clearly picked someone with the Yiddish-sounding name possible. And up until May 2010, when the 88-year-old Betty White hosted, she was the oldest person ever to host it. She remains the only non-celebrity. Her hosting began with a joke involving her and John Belushi sharing a joint, followed by a marijuana-induced obsession with a bowl of fruit.
So good.
I
love the sound of her. Tina Fey, who was on Saturday Night Live for a long time, was the head writer on the show.
Mm-hmm.
She said Paris Hilton was the worst ever host of the show.
Yeah, I can believe that.
She called her a piece of shit, which is, for someone as witty as Tina Fey, she really just, like, words seemed to fail her to describe how bad Paris Hilton was the host. She said Paris asked for a sketch where she could play Jessica Simpson just to mock her, because, and I quote, "I hate her, she's fat." And was so uninterested in everyone else working on the show that the cast actually had a bet that if Paris Hilton asked you a personal question, everyone else would pay you $10. And a personal question included something as banal as, "How are you?" She never got round to it, apparently. Bill Hader, who is famous now for being on HBO's Barry,
a serialization of your life.
My life, yes, and my love of tea. He said that Justin Bieber, when he appeared in the show, was a bit of a douche.
Mm-hmm.
He had an entourage of 20 people with him, including one guy who just walked around to hold Bieber's slice of pizza.
No!
In a 2014 interview, and also on an episode hosted by Nicolas Cage, Lorne Michaels, who produced the show, said Steven Seagal was the worst host they had ever had. Seagal hosted in 1991. And Lorne called it just a really hard week.
Oh!
Former cast member David Spade also said it was he was a terrible host. Seagal apparently refused to do the sketches the cast wrote for him, wrote terrible sketches himself for him to appear in. And they tried to pull the episode. It was going to be so bad.
Christ.
He was banned from ever appearing again. To give you a sample of how bad the show was, the first sketch is two muscular Germans spoofing Arnold Schwarzenegger and implying that he's gay. And Seagal comes on, in the middle of the sketch and declares his own movies superior to Schwarzenegger's movies, and telling the Germans to, you know, they should fanboy over him instead. And then he came out, and so the host always does a monologue straight to camera, sort of as the big open. Mm-hmm. They sort of do a cold open sketch, and then they come onto stage as themselves and monologue. And Seagal apparently ad-libbed his monologue talking about the decline in manliness in the USA. And then grabbed a guitar and started playing Kung Fu Fighting.
Oh, I mean, that is objectively funny.
He's released a blues album, Steven Seagal.
Has he?
Yeah. It's everything you'd hope. I implore you and all your listeners to go and look for it. It's on YouTube. It's
worst
everything
celebrity
you'd
album.
Expect.
Worst celebrity album is definitely a topic in the pipeline on the show.
Also, I'd like to hope, since he's quite a Russophile, that he plays the blues on a balalaika.
Yes.
Well, is the balalaika Russian or Greek?
Sounds
Russian.
QI Elf? No idea.
No.
I mean, it's a really fun word to say.
Balalaika. It sounds Greek.
It does. It's Russian!
It is Russian. Russian. Okay.
Sweet, well, we can cut that shit out.
Hurrah.
The joke has got foundations in truth.
We also voted, so Milton Berle hosted Saturday Night Live. So Milton Berle was a famous comedian in America in the 50s. He hosted his own, back when TV was live, like variety shows. And he was known as Uncle Milty, I think, to his fans. Like an iconic figure. So when Saturday Night Live appeared, they wanted to get someone who had major sort of comedy chops, a legendary figure to host the show.
Yeah, he's right up there with Groucho Marx for cigar-wielding one-liner crackers.
Yeah. Also, Milton Berle, fun fact, famous for having a massive penis.
That's the only thing I know about Milton Berle. Enormous penis. I don't know who he is.
Do you have a list of QI?
Yes.
Famously well-endowed
celebrities? No, it's my own personal list.
that would be an Only Connect group.
Yes.
Milton Berle, Justin Timberlake,
Mark Wahlberg,
Mark Wahlberg in Boogie Nights.
Yeah. I mean, they already did songs about butts in the last series, so I think this means is Victoria would be very pro, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, Milton Berle, when he appeared on SNL, apparently didn't get on with anybody. He sort of basically saw himself as much like as comedy royalty compared to the cast, who he thought was sort of scruffy, hippy-dippy kinds. Yeah. During Berle's monologue to camera, Bill Murray apparently dropped a piece of piping off camera to distract him. And the only funny line came as Berle ad-libbed, "Oh, there's NBC dropping another show." and apparently he was told to wind up his monologue by producers sort of after 5 minutes. He was given the sort of the wind it up signal. Mm-hmm. And he was going to do 20 minutes. He was like, "Wind it up, what? What?" And then when they were going to commercial, you can see and hear him ranting at people on camera, going, "How dare you sort of tell a legend like me to stop talking?" At the end of the show, he sang a really maudlin song, interspersing it with some gags. Like gags he'd been doing for 25 years as well. And sort of reflecting on his career. And at the end of the song, he got a standing ovation from the audience, which apparently Berle had pre-arranged with a friend of his who was in the audience to start a standing ovation. Lorne Michaels, the host, the producer, was furious with him for doing that, saying he was never going to appear
again. Also don't know the full story about Milton Berle, because I didn't realise until this podcast that he had a legendarily large penis.
Yeah.
Apparently, according to the tell-all book Live from New York, an uncensored history of Saturday Night Live, Berle got a little bit pervy backstage, a little bit, you know. I mean, listen, he is a great of American comedy and so influential, and clearly he influenced Louis C.K. because apparently back in the dressing room with the writer Alan Zwiebel, I'm going to quote the author Tom Shales here, describing a moment with the writer Alan Zwiebel. Berle parted his bathrobe
like the Red Sea. Let my penis go free.
That is not how I remember the hymn going. Berle parted his robe.
The 10-inch commandments.
That absolutely exists. It must do. Oh my God.
Berle parted his bathrobe.
Berle parted his bathrobe, and he just takes out this anaconda. And he goes, what do you think of the boy?
Wow.
The boy?
The boy, right?
Come up with a better nickname for him.
Not even the man. It's the boy.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's, yeah. I also have one more SNL host I want to talk about, who is the comedian, actor, and talk show host Martin Lawrence, who was sort of known for very bawdy stand-up. And he, not very good, like sort of like, oh, people are like this, aren't they, for 5 minutes. He came out for his monologue and moaned about the censors. And then he sort of launches into what's barely a routine about Lorena Bobbitt cutting her husband's penis off and then someone finding it. And like basically the thrust of it is, oh, it's a white penis, so it's little, so they have to squint to find it. And then he goes on to moan about women, and I quote here, not washing their asses properly.
That's true, we don't wash our asses.
He basically goes on to complain about, you know, he put a finger up there, and I really apologise for this, he put a finger up there and you put it out and it smells bad, and I want to kiss women all over and I can't because they don't wash their ass properly, and exhorting women to douche. However, at the point at which he complains that women don't wash their asses properly, he gets a big laugh. At this point, in reruns of the episode, it cuts to a screen showing these words and a voiceover saying, at this point in his monologue, Martin begins a commentary on what he considers the decline in standards of feminine hygiene in this country. Although we at Saturday Night Live take no stand on this issue one way or the other, network policy prevents us from rebroadcasting this portion of his remarks. In summary, Martin feels, or felt at the time, that the failure of many young women to bathe thoroughly is a serious problem that demands our attention. He explores this problem, citing numerous examples from his personal experience, and ends by proposing several imaginative solutions. It was a frank and lively presentation, and nearly cost us all our jobs. We now return to the conclusion of Martin's monologue. Got to pitch our actual.
Yeah, we did have to pitch. I've got one little one that I found, which is I can't tell whether it's the best host or the worst host in the world, but there is an event taking place in Texas, or has just taken place in Texas, which is a Chuck Norris lookalike event hosted by Chuck Norris. And you can pay a $30 registration fee, and for that you get a sweet belt buckle, a fake beard, and a Chuck Norris-style T-shirt.
Hang on, if you need a fake beard, I feel like you haven't entered the competition properly.
It begins, for reasons that I don't fully understand, with a 5K race.
You only look like Chuck Norris if you've, like, run 5 kilometres first.
Yep. And then at the end of the race, the prizes will be awarded for the best male Chuck Norris costume, the best female Chuck Norris costume, and the best kid Chuck Norris costume for attendees under 12.
Wow.
They were also having to set a world record for the greatest number of Norrises in one place. So, just glorious. But for my choice, we are going, as we so often do, go to Japan.
Yes.
And we are going to Nagasaki.
Not in 1945.
Not in 1945. where one guy...
The guy who opened the door to the bomb. Come on in!
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. We're going to the Henna Hotel. Now, Henna in Japanese literally means weird. And it's a hotel that's part of like a high-tech, eco-friendly amusement park. And on the website, they boast about how excitement meets comfort here at the Henna Hotel, introducing state-of-the-art technologies, because the Henna Hotel is the world's first hotel staffed by robots.
It's like an episode of The Jetsons.
There are two robots on reception.
One always lies. One always tells the truth.
One of them is the classic Japanese female, slightly creepy, probably used to be a sex doll.
Okay.
The other one is a velociraptor in a burger flipper's hat.
Clever girl.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why isn't she working in the kitchen?
I don't... All right. Misogyny.
I don't know Because he said the other one was female. Oh wait, are they male and female?
Well, I've not checked the gender of the Velociraptor.
Sorry, I shouldn't gender the Velociraptor robot. Why aren't they working in the kitchen?
It's very hard to gender Velociraptors.
Have you ever tried to sex a Velociraptor?
Not against its will.
So it's developed by a guy called Hideo Sawada, and he said the hotel uses robots to save labour costs. However. they still can't make the beds. there is also, because they can't sort of do security, there is 24/7 CCTV watching everything. And the way to get in is via facial recognition technology, which is, again, super creepy.
Yeah.
The concierge is a series of lockers that are manned by one of those one-armed robots that will pick up your luggage and put it rather cack-handedly into a locker.
Oh, like a claw game.
Yes, exactly.
Like in Toy Story. The claw.
Yeah, precisely that. And he says that there's also, he uses drones to deliver snacks to the rooms.
Through the corridors of this hotel.
Yes.
Low-flying drones.
Yeah. The robots are multilingual. They can speak Chinese, Korean, Japanese, and English, but it's not all of it.
Is it all voice recognition, or is it like you type to them?
No, it's meant to be voice recognition.
Okay.
But the female robot in particular, she's just got she will speak to you from her script. But
okay.
But if you ask her any particular question, she's not exactly Siri or Alexa.
Okay.
So and brilliantly, one of the FAQs on the website is. Are the robots first aid trained? And it's like, no, in the event
that they get CPR.
Yeah.
You could probably shock yourself with them.
Yeah.
You struggle for the breathing stuff. That's amazing.
Yeah. So,
what happens if they break down?
And you're sleeping on the street, I guess.
So presumably they have like human staff who are there to staff the robots.
Yes, but I think they hide behind a screen or they work remotely. They literally, I've checked this on the website, they cannot even call you a cab. This is your hotel receptionist.
What? But like, you can order an Uber on your phone.
Well, you could do that.
But because you can order an Uber on your phone, surely there's the technology for a machine to order you a cab.
I mean, as of this article I read about was posted last year. So the robots, they do have a robot for parking your slippers.
But you can't order a cab?
Yeah.
What? How many more people need to park slippers than order a cab from a hotel?
Well, you get, after a hard day of being a tourist around Tokyo, you can't expend the energy to pop your slippers into there.
Is like putting slippers into a specific marked area a thing in hotels in Japan? I just kick my slippers off.
Well, I mean, they're very neat and tidy people. Okay. And clearly, if you park your slippers in the wrong place, then a parking warden robot will come along and give your slippers
your
ticket.
Slippers.
Yeah. So
I feel like they've gone to market a bit too soon with this hotel.
I think you're right. So that's my selection, my offering to you, Lydia, as the world's worst host.
I have gone down the line of dinner host for my offering as world's worst host. I thought about Lucrezia Borgia, daughter of Pope Alexander VI, who, according to probably unreliable sources, had a ring filled with cyanide that she could, you know, tip into the wine glass of a passing enemy of her family at a dinner party. No cheersing with them, presumably.
No.
Or her father, Pope Alexander VI. Yep, her dad was a pope. Who hosted a banquet called the Banquet of the... the Banquet of the Chestnuts. Where he arranged for 50 prostitutes, male and female, to appear, dance at this dinner party with attendants and others who were present. At first in their garments and then naked. And then after dinner, the candelabra with the burning candles were taken from the tables and placed on the floor and chestnuts strewn around, which the naked courtesans picked up, creeping on hands and knees between the chandeliers, while the Pope, Cesare Borgia, and his sister Lucretia looked on. Finally, prizes were announced for those who could perform the act most often with the courtesans, such as tunics of silk, shoes, barrels, and other things. So, that would have been a fun thing to be a dinner party guest at. Mm-hmm. Sun Hao, the last emperor of the Wu, one of the three ancient Chinese states, he used to, at drunk at his dinner parties, he would get others to get drunk with him too, And he once got so angry at one of his Imperial counselors for pretending to be drunk when he wasn't that he had him beheaded on the spot. Yeah, so he was just trying to pay up to the emperor. Have you heard the term the Thyestean banquet? So a Thyestean banquet is a meal for where human flesh is served.
Mm-hmm.
So that comes from the legend of Thyestes, who he committed adultery with Aerope, the wife of his brother Atreus. Atreus found out about it and had Thyestes' sons killed and served him as a meal. By the way, Atreus' sons were Agamemnon and Menelaus from the Legend of Troy fame. Vlad the Third, Dracula, he used to have feasts for his nobles and then impale them at the end of them. So, you know, feed them kebabs and then make kebabs out of them, presumably. And then he also once hosted a banquet for the poor and elderly and sick and helpless, and then sealed the doors to the building and had it burnt to the ground. His reasoning was that killing the poor would bring an end to their poverty, which seems like quite a Jacob Rees-Mogg solution. And I also read about a lady called Nitocris, who was seems to be an Egyptian queen, possibly mythic. She was the wife and sister of an Egyptian king, and when he died, he was murdered by his subjects, and she became the sole ruler of Egypt. And she decided to avenge his death by having a underground banquet hall constructed and connected to the River Nile, so that when all the nobles were in there and feasting, she slipped out and then had a conduit opened and flooded the chamber to drown her enemies.
Oh my god.
That's pretty inventive.
Yeah.
She then committed suicide by throwing herself into a chamber of hot ashes too, because she knew that she'd, you know, she'd be killed as a result of her actions. So my candidate is the Roman Emperor Domitian. Well, yes, I thought of Elagabalus, who had his dinner guests drowned in petals. So Diocletian wasn't very popular. He was quite authoritarian, autocratic, sidelined the Senate far more than his predecessors. And he around the year 90 AD, he invited a lot of aristocrats to a banquet at his palace at the Palatine Hill. When they arrived, they were ushered into a room that was completely painted black. Black marble, black paint, black velvet drapes. There was barely lit at all, just some flickering funeral lamps. Each guest's place at the table was marked with a gravestone engraved with his or her own name. And instead of soft couches, they were reclining on benches, like really hard benches. They assumed they were about to be murdered, as you would,
yeah,
by a vicious, you know, emperor who had he'd killed a lot of people in his previous career, and they weren't sort of calmed when the meal arrived, because the meal was served by naked serving boys painted black from head to toe, emerging from the shadows.
This sounds like a heavy metal album launch.
It really does. They carried food, which was itself painted black, on black onyx plates. And there was no music playing or anything. And then suddenly the emperor's voice rings out. And he just drones on really monotonously about the inevitability of death and decay. And at the end of the meal, the guests were still convinced they were going to be murdered. But they were taken home in litters. They were taken all the way there, and no, they weren't murdered at all. They were safely dropped off, and when their nerves had recovered, then there was a knock on the door like an hour later, and they're like, this is it, it's really going to happen now. It was a messenger from the emperor arriving, not to kill them, but bearing an ancient gift bag, their own personal gravestone from the banquet, one of the black plates, and one of the waiters, the black painted children, now doused in fragrant perfume, given to them as a servant. And no one is entirely sure why he threw this dinner in the first place. Some thought it was just like sadism. Some thought it might have been to honour the people who had died in his recent campaigns in Dacia. It might have just been because he was a bit mad.
Yeah, and the guests afterwards went, I thought there was a lot of attention to detail, but ultimately it was quite creepy, so it's a 7 from me.
Yeah. So, Lydia, the choice is yours. We have laid before you Domitian and... who did you say again?
I said the Japanese hotel.
The Japanese hotel, yeah.
Manned by robots.
I mean, on the surface of it, both of these things sound awesome.
Are you a secret goth?
Who doesn't want a dinosaur robot? And the gravestone thing, like, I'm a big fan of personalised gifts, so
He definitely went all out. They apparently were carved in silver, these gravestones, so, you know, they weren't cheap.
I think, I mean, I'm going to go for the hotel. Sorry.
Oh, wow. Any particular reason?
Yeah.
The meal, I mean, okay, you spend the whole of it thinking you're going to be murdered, but there's a lot of effort's gone into that. It sounds beautiful. It's a little creepy. I think if I'd survived, I think I'd have looked back on that as a good night out. Like,
yeah, it's basically early immersive theatre.
Yeah, like I could get on board with that. I mean, as much as I think I'd enjoy arriving at that hotel and the little velociraptor and how important that, the fact that it would then not be able to do anything apart from park my slippers, whatever that means. Yeah. I mean, not to mention the 24/7 security and the inability to call a cab and drones flying up and down the corridors.
Like, You'd like to think from watching Jurassic Park, the Velociraptor would at least be able to open the doors for you.
Yes.
Like, not at first, but...
It'll learn.
Yeah.
It'll learn. And if you have an enemy...
Yeah,
if you have an enemy, bring them with you and incite the Velociraptor to violence. And then blame it on the machines. It'll be one of those things, like, if you want to sabotage, like, to murder someone. I've thought about how I'm going to kill you, Ben.
Right.
It's going to be one of those driverless cars where I hijack the algorithm, and then I can just blame the robot.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I'll never drive again.
That's the idea. So congratulations then, Ben, and your hotel of robots.
I've managed to make like a dystopian Pixar movie a winner on this.
Before we go, I've got the world's worst news of the week. This comes from Ireland, where Katie Taylor, the legendary Irish boxer, has just united the four belts in women's boxing.
In a bout that she probably shouldn't have won.
She's the undisputed female world lightweight champion, Ben, and the judges spoke.
Yes, and the judges spoke incorrectly and should have spoken in favour of her Belgian opponent, so I read.
You're not a boxing judge, Ben. regardless of that, Katie Taylor arrived home at Dublin Airport a couple of days ago, and where she was greeted by Minister of Sport Shane Ross.
Mm-hmm.
Shane Ross has a reputation of being someone who quite likes to big himself up.
Uh-oh.
And Katie emerged through the door into the arrivals lounge, followed very closely by Shane Ross, to be greeted by cheering crowds and a bank of photographers and journalists who were ushering her, pointing her this way and that, saying, Katie, this way, this way, this way. Everywhere Katie Taylor looked, Shane Ross was lurking beside her like an evil shadow. Every photo and sort of camera angle and footage from it just has him over her shoulder in a really awkward, like, and there's one point at which she moves a bit away from him and he sort of seems to scuttle after her a little bit. It's really, really creepy and really self-aggrandizing. And the nice thing about it, people have compared it to when Stephen Roach, the Irish cyclist, won the Tour de France in 1987. The Irish Prime Minister at the time, Charlie Haughey, showed up in Paris on the podium with Stephen Roach.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So Shane Ross is very much doing a similar impression of that, but has led to some excellent internet work where people have photoshopped Shane Ross into other epic moments, including being in the Bobby Moore position holding the World Cup in 1966. In the recent photo of Harry and Meghan with the royal family at their wedding, the epic selfie from the Ellen DeGeneres Oscars.
Yep.
And also beside Neil Armstrong on the moon. nice tweets such as, Katie Taylor apologises for ruining Shane Ross's big moment. Katie Taylor rushed to hospital to have Shane Ross surgically removed. It's my favourite one. So congratulations to Katie Taylor, and well done the internet for rightly shaming Shane Ross.
Damn right. Well, thank you, Lydia, for coming and being a judge on the show. If people want to find out more about you and what you do, where can they find you and your doings online?
So you can follow me on Twitter, which is at Lydia Mizon, LYDIAMIZON. Or if you want to follow QI on Twitter, I am involved in the tweets that happen on there sometimes. That's QIKIPEDIA. So it's sort of Quickipedia.
Quickipedia.
Beautiful. Well, we're all off to reception to complain as to why the chocolate on our pillow has been savaged by some Neolithic claws. Until next time.
Bye.
Bye.
We're going to have so many people complain about Neolithic.
Is a Paleolithic. Right, fuck it, we're doing that again. Until next time, we're all off to reception to complain as to why the chocolate on our pillow has been savaged by some Paleolithic claws. Definitely said that the first time.
I think they're probably Cretaceous.
Go.